Good morning. Counsel, can both of you hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, good. Before we begin, we're going to do a little demonstration about how we keep time when we're doing a virtual oral argument. If you look in the upper left-hand corner of your screen, you will see a green start sign when it's time for you to go. When you have 5 minutes left on your argument, you'll see a yellow 5 minute sign. And when it's time to conclude, you'll see a red stop sign. I will pretty much hold you to that red stop sign. And I know sometimes when you get involved in an argument, you're not thinking about that. And it's a little bit harder to direct yourself to the upper corner of the screen when you have so many faces to look at. However, if you are answering the question of a justice and the red sign comes up, you don't need to ask me if you can continue. So you've answered that question. But once you're done with that, I'll probably rein you in if you don't rein yourself in. So answer the question, and that's the way we'll handle it. Now, are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
I will call our first case of the day, State versus Meyer. Attorney Lindberg, will you proceed?
Good morning, Justices and Chief Justice. I want to just thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, albeit under less than traditional circumstances. By way of making an introductory remark, I would note that Beyer initiated appellate review in this case by appealing the trial court's decision to deny his discovery motion pertaining to the state's computer system, as well as its subsequent motion denying his motion related motion to suppress. Throughout the trial level process, those motions were conceptually and literally intertwined as he renewed his arguments in several submissions to the trial court, both written and oral. He still believes that they ought to be considered in tandem, given the specific issues raised, as noted in his briefs. But that being said, and while I hope we have some time to discuss those issues today, I am cognizant of the question on certification and will begin by outlining Beyer's position on that threshold matter. So to start, Beyer's asking this court to determine that a trial by stipulation is a valid form of adjudication when a defendant waives his right to a trial by jury and a court renders a verdict based on stipulations of fact submitted to the court for consideration. It's Beyer's position that if a stipulation of fact is evidence, then a series of stipulations of fact should constitute an evidentiary record from which a fact finder can duly render a trial verdict. If the factual stipulations provide a sufficient record in terms of the requisite proof of each element of the given crime charged, that verdict can then be guilty.
Mr. Lindberg, Attorney Lindberg, can you address for me the last bullet point or last number in the stipulation, the statement that Jacob Beyer agrees to have the court find him guilty based upon the above stipulated set of facts? That's not usually part of stipulated facts, is it?
I think that the drafting of that final provision could have been tighter. The intention here was to the intention here was clear, to preserve this discovery issue on appeal. As far as that, as the stipulations themselves go, ideally, or what we're trying to adhere to, is to create a record from which the court could infer and render a verdict.
Couldn't that have been done just the way just during a court trial with actual stipulated facts without that piece, which to me it seems to be causing the real problem here about whether or not this looks like a guilty plea or not?
Yes, it could have been omitted. I don't think we'd probably be here at all. But I guess as we kind of or as we discussed in the in our briefs, it was more along the lines of just a, an intellectual concession that this was a foregone conclusion, and it tracked the language of the case in Adams versus Peterson, I believe, which we referenced in the brief, where the parties agreed that it was the expectation of the parties that the defendant will be found guilty on several enumerated counts. So today I'm asking the court to consider that last language in the stipulation, and I suppose in addition, counsel's remarks to the trial court on the record when specifically queried about the sufficiency of the evidence. I'm asking this court to find that it's consistent with the holding in Adams and doesn't and did not have the effect of transmogrifying this to a guilty plea. From, I guess, a general standpoint, Byer would point the court to 972.02 sub 3, which refers to bench trials. And it indicates only that in a case tried without a jury, the court shall make a general finding and may in addition find the facts specially. It does not prescribe findings based on stipulations of fact. I'd note that 972.13, referring to judgment, does not suggest there's any impropriety as relates to trial stipulations either. So when it comes to this notion or the question raised by the state insofar as the statutorily enumerated exception to the guilty plea waiver akin to 971.31 sub 10, I don't think that there's a need for such an enumeration because it would be inherently superfluous to have one, as a trial is a trial, as long as it's based on an evidentiary record, there's no need to create any sort of similar exception.
Counsel, your position is, as I understand it, that, this is an exercise in some, judicial administration line drawing, right? And the guilty plea waiver rule is a rule of judicial administration, not necessarily a creature of statute, although we do have statutory exceptions to it. In your rule that you're, I think, proposing is basically, listen, this isn't a guilty plea. It doesn't come, it's not a formal guilty plea, and let's leave the guilty plea waiver rule to formal guilty pleas, which I take to be the position of the amicus as well. I wonder if you might have any comment on what the amicus said and any follow-up as to why you think this line-drawing exercise there makes the most sense, acknowledging some of the weaknesses that have been pointed out by your friend on the other side.
Yes, Your Honor, that's an accurate recitation of our position, and I think of the amicus position as well. I agree with the amicus discussion about, the slippery slope that the court might open itself up to were we to get into a discussion of the degree to which analysis of the degree to which certain stipulations might constitute a guilty plea versus ones that would suffice and satisfy the requirements for a trial. I think that touches upon the sort of general judicial economy position that we've taken because it benefits there's obviously a benefit in not necessitating a trial in a situation similar to Byers, but there's also a benefit to not forcing trial courts to analyze the degree to which which the stipulations of fact may factor into a trial verdict without mutating into the de facto guilty plea, as the state has called it. Creating rules requiring courts of the state to determine how much stipulating exactly is equivalent to a guilty plea, I think would just complicate the system even further. Our position and the position taken in the non-party brief is that judicial administration is more easily effectuated by drawing a clear line in the sand and indicating that anything short of a formal plea of guilty coupled with the requisite plea colloquy and admonitions is distinct from a guilty verdict rendered after stipulations are made in the order that they were here.
Is there a danger, Attorney Lindberg, though, in what you're saying in terms of people pushing that line and avoiding having to go through the colloquy of the guilty plea and all of what that takes and just submitting what they call stipulated facts in which people then in the stipulated facts agree to be found guilty as happened here? Is there any danger in that?
I suppose there is in theory, but I think the danger is curbed by the fact that this procedure has to be endorsed by both the court and the state as well. The state has to participate in this. They don't have to agree to it. And I think that it can be easily disincentivized if this court were to hold that individuals who go through this type of procedure should get no benefit for acceptance of responsibility. Because, you know, fair is fair. If we're going to call this a trial or a court trial or verdict rendered at a court trial, I don't think that the defendant doing this sort of thing should be afforded the same sort of benefit of accepting responsibility that a similarly situated defendant who does plead guilty would. So I think that this may change. I guess I don't see this leading to a proliferation of this procedure. I think it would be limited in rare circumstances where there is a discovery motion, where the defense feels that they have a compelling discovery motion that tracks along, perhaps, as in this case here, with a suppression motion.
Counsel, I just want to ask why you said the state would need to agree to it. I understand pragmatically why that would be true, but you also said the court needed to agree to it. Why would that be?
Well, it's my understanding that the jury, the waiver statute requires the court and the state would have to agree to a waiver, a jury trial waiver. As far as the stipulation is concerned, I don't know if there is a rule which would require a court to accept a stipulation of facts in lieu of a trial to the bench. In other contexts, I believe a court can elect to reject stipulations where they're, you know, in the course of a trial's proceeding based on issues that may arise. So it's my understanding that the court would have the opportunity to reject this if it was so inclined.
Counsel, in your response just before Justice Hagedorn's question, you made reference to the phrase fair is fair. You also made reference to the circumstance in which the state participates in or agrees to the procedure. I note on page 12, footnote 7 of the certification, that the Court of Appeals indicates that on appeal you have an objection to the use, that the state's objection on appeal to the use of this procedure smacks of bad faith and flagrant unfairness. So your comment of what's fair is fair draws my attention to that footnote in the certification. What's the difference, if any, between the state agreeing on this kind of a procedure as opposed to participating in this type of procedure? Is there any difference of import?
I don't think that there is necessarily. I think that the state's participation in this sort of procedure implicitly or implies its agreement with the procedure.
That seems to me correct. I just note that you had the distinction in your response, or at least that's what I heard, participate or agrees. And then as to the rest of your comment, flagrant unfairness, you assert. What, if any, part should that play in our analysis of this case today? Essentially, I think that's an estoppel argument.
Right. And that's in reference to the case in Rykoff, where there was the plea agreement where the parties explicitly contracted around the guilty plea waiver rule, and noted that that the defendant there was preserving his right to appeal an issue, but then I believe the state took a contrary position once the case was actually on appeal, and that was another. It was just another reason the court mentioned in that case, or another justification for remanding, because it was a violation of his due process to violate that plea agreement. So that's, I guess, what that footnote in our initial appellate brief was referencing. The state wants this court to hold that the guilty plea waiver rule would apply not only in this case, where Beyer admitted to the sufficiency of the evidence, but also in all cases where the defendant does not stipulate to the sufficiency of the evidence, but presents no defense. And I think that the amicus brief discusses this at some length, but I think that would also complicate the adjudicative landscape even further, and it would require the courts to develop some workable framework by which to determine what constitutes a real defense. I think that also would turns the burden of proof on its head, and it's up to the state to meet its burden of proof by the evidence that it puts on, whether that's via testimony or stipulation. I don't think that a defendant should be deemed to have pled guilty just by virtue of agreeing to allow a trial court to make its determination based on the evaluation of the state's case in isolation. And as we intimated in our reply brief, I Byers takes a more expansive view of the concept of a defense than I think the state does. I think that litigating a motion to dispress and the discovery issue in his case, that does constitute a defense. And I also, on another related note, I think that these stipulations, even where the sufficiency of the evidence is agreed to, I think that the stipulations are still a fruit of an adversarial proceeding, because again, the state's involved in this process. This isn't Byers effectuating this all on his own. I just wanted to then, address some of the concerns the state specifically outlined in its brief. The state has some concerns about its expectation of finality, the interest in finality, and whether or not that would be compromised by sanctioning the type of procedure used in this case. I would say that there's still a continued partial interest in finality here, because a denial on appeal effectively ends the proceedings. As far as an appellate burden is concerned, I think that's heavily outweighed by the benefit economy-wise of avoiding a more traditionally contested trial in a situation similar to this case. I would also note would have been more or less an identical appellate burden here if you would have sought interlocutory review. I think that would have likely been denied, and we would end up in the same situation. As far as the colloquy is concerned, I think that the jury waiver colloquy is all that would be necessary in this case, as in any bench trial, and that's all that should be required. The state observed or argued that the trial court in Byers' case went a little above and beyond that, but I don't think that is something that was necessarily necessary. It was just a thorough job done by the trial court. In terms of collateral effects, I think.
Mr. Lindberg, let me ask you a question, sort of, I guess, springboarding off of something Justice Hagedorn asked you early on. And that is, and I think you used the term slippery slope. I'm trying to think, if this procedure is allowable, why every defendant who is charged with possession of child pornography would not use it. Because this seems to me to be really a great solution if you're charged with possession of child pornography, because you don't have to say I possessed child pornography. We're saying you don't have to plead guilty, and you don't have to sit through a trial where the images that may have been up on someone's computer are shown to 12 members of the public. So why wouldn't you? I mean, who charged with child pornography wouldn't want to go through this process? You're talking about what you said is, well, they wouldn't be treated the same as they would as if they had taken responsibility. But if you're convicted of child pornography, there's a mandatory minimum sentence one way or the other.
Right. There is a mandatory minimum sentence, but I still believe that that you, if you lose the benefit of the acceptance of responsibility, that can change the sentencing pattern. A court can, I guess, ascribe whatever significance it will to the stipulated facts at trial versus a guilty plea. But I think that the administration of justice would be better served if the defendant it ends up being more heavily penalized and not receiving that benefit.
What about the victims of child pornography? Aren't we creating a system here whereby someone is putting is viewing photos of children, pornographic pictures of children or videos of children, and that person is not having to take responsibility? They can, they don't have to plead guilty. They don't have to, or no contest. They don't have to sit in a jury trial where they could be found guilty. They just get to, navigate their way through the middle, and the victims are left wondering whether or not this person actually is taking responsibility. And for victims of crime, as I'm sure you would imagine, especially victim of a crime like this, having someone take responsibility is hugely important as far as their healing is concerned.
Well, yes, I agree with all that in principle.
You can answer the question, please.
I agree with that in principle, but I think that he does have an alternative recourse here, and that's to go through with a full-blown trial and force the state to put on this evidence, which would tend to, I guess I'm speculating a little bit, but I imagine that that's a painful process for the victims as well. This is, a swifter resolution. The conviction, he still ends up being convicted, but it doesn't require the victim to bear the burden of that process and reliving any sort of trauma that they might have experienced as relates to the offense. So I think that cuts both ways. This would be my answer.
Okay.
That's my
Thank
time.
You.
Thank you.
Attorney Jansen, are you prepared to proceed?
I am.
Please do.
Thank you, Chief Justice. And may it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Kara Jansen for the state of Wisconsin. Under this court's precedent, court and party approved workarounds of the guilty plea waiver rule are not permitted. And unfortunately, that's exactly what happened in this case. And I want to be clear right at the outset. We believe that we made a mistake agreeing to this procedure at the circuit court. We think that we overlooked this court's decision in Rykoff, which we interpret as saying that we didn't have the discretion to go along with this procedure. So we're here today to ask this court whether our interpretation of Rykoff is correct, and ultimately because we are concerned about the potential fallout if this procedure is allowed to go unchecked. So this is what we're asking this court to do today. We're asking this court to hold that defendants cannot circumvent the guilty plea waiver rule by using the procedure at issue in this case. And I view this as essentially asking this court to double down on Rykoff. We believe Rykoff says that circuit courts and parties do not have the discretion to bypass the guilty plea waiver rule for economic reasons. The reason being is that the legislature has not sanctioned that kind of procedure in order to reduce the number of fully contested trials.
Attorney Jansen, just to get more specific, are you disputing the ability of having a court trial where facts are stipulated to, or are you specifically talking about the language in this case that I had talked with Attorney Lindberg about where there was an agreement as to guilt? What exactly are you saying?
Sure. So we're not arguing that stipulated trials aren't allowed under this court's precedent. They are allowed. We cited the case Kempe State. That's where this whole idea of a trial on stipulated facts came from.
What we are saying is that we think that a stipulated court trial still should have to meet this court's definition of a trial, in that there has to be something disputed, whether it's a point of law or a point of fact. In the Kemp v. State case, if you take a look at it, I think in that case they relied on the preliminary hearing transcripts. And then at this proceeding, at the stipulated court trial, the parties made arguments based on the facts, right? I assume they argued the fact, you know, the defense argued the facts don't meet the legal elements of the offense.
So you're asking us to draw a line of what it, of having to still have a dispute. So you are saying it, you can't just have a court trial where the defendant says, I stipulate to all these facts. Now, Your Honor, it's up to you to determine whether or not those meet the elements of the case. You're saying that the defendant would actually have to argue these do not meet or this element is not met.
Well, I guess to be clear, in the words of former AAG Dave Perlman, that's probably the platinum package that we're asking for here.
Okay. Tell me about the gold package. Right.
Okay. So that's the facts of this case, right? We think that this is the easy case for deciding what was effectively a guilty plea, in that Mr. Beyer not only admitted that he committed a past act, he conceded, or, you know, he consented to a judgment of conviction being entered against him. That's the hallmark of a guilty plea, and that's what triggers the guilty plea waiver rule.
Counsel, let me tell you what troubles me about your argument, and maybe you can assuage me here. So, I do view this, and maybe I'm wrong, and I'll be persuaded otherwise by my colleagues or by your arguments today, but I'm not sure that Rykoff controls what we do here. It seems to me that we have a question of judicial administration here. In your position of sort of a functional guilty plea, I understand the reasons for it, right? I mean, there was a clear effort to get beyond, to get by the traditional guilty plea waiver rule. But I have two questions I'd like you to address. And one is that, number one, this wasn't a guilty plea. And so as a sort of strict matter of what we have said in the past, we're not in the realm of a guilty plea. And so the guilty plea waiver rule, at least as a technical matter, doesn't seem to apply to me. And so it seems to me what you're asking us to do is expand the guilty plea waiver rule to find some sort of functional equivalent. And I'd like you to address that. The second piece, and it's a related point, is that if we go there and we're asked to go there, to me, when we're crafting rules of judicial administration, the most important thing, not the most important, but among our highest values, I think, should be clarity. And I am deeply worried that what you're asking us to do decreases the kind of clarity that we at least currently have, and that currently leads to operation here. And I think the amicus made that point, quite well too, as did your opposing counsel. And so if you could address those two points and maybe help me see where I need to think through things differently.
Sure. On the first point, obviously, we know this isn't a perfect fit with Rykoff, because obviously this wasn't a formal guilty plea. We concede that. But I think the point to me that is significant here is that the only reason why this wasn't a formal guilty plea is because everybody agreed to call it a trial in order to bypass the guilty plea waiver rule. And we think in that way, this clearly implicates the principle of Rykoff, in that it is a court and party approved workaround of the rule. It's just a different flavor than the situation in Rykoff. They both involve procedures where everybody agrees that the guilty plea waiver rule would apply, but for coming up with a creative way around the rule.
Let me just push back on that real quickly. So, if I unquestionably, this was an effort to get around that, right? But if I get a tax break that's lawful and get around paying the taxes I'm supposed to pay if I'm in a certain tax bracket or something like that, I'm unquestionably trying to pay less taxes, right? And I get that. But it doesn't mean that I have somehow violated the tax laws. This is still not a guilty plea, right? So this may be a functional workaround of it, no question. But it's not a formal guilty plea. So it does seem like you're asking us to expand the guilty plea waiver rule into things that are not formal guilty pleas, but that smell a lot like guilty pleas.
Well, I just view it as a superficial distinction. because, you know, we know why this happened. And it would have been a guilty plea, but for the agreement to call it something else. And so, I mean, that is our interpretation of Rykoff, is that parties can't be creative in trying to dodge the guilty plea waiver rule for economic reasons. And so, you know, I think to adopt Mr. Byers' position in this case does require a departure from the Rykoff decision. And I see that you unmuted yourself.
Yeah, well, I was just gonna, and if you want to address the second question, this sort of clarity issue that bothers me about what you're putting forward, help us out with that.
Sure. So I don't share the same concern as the amicus brief. And the reason why is that I think if this court does what the state is asking for, which is to double down on Rykoff, say we meant what we said when we said that court and parties can't find ways around the rule for economic reasons. And I think if this court makes clear that a stipulated court trial still has to meet the definition of a trial and that there has to be something disputed, a point of law or a point of fact, I don't think we're going to be seeing murky procedures like this going forward, because I think people are going to get it. It's either got to be a plea or it's got to be a trial. And in terms of clarity, you know, I guess my concern is that it's the state's position here that this procedure is essentially a new way of terminating a criminal case in Wisconsin. It's not a plea and it's not a trial. And you know, we've raised a lot of concern in our brief about questions that we're going to have to ask if this procedure is allowed to go forward. And I think one of the most important questions is what kind of colloquy are we mandating for this type of situation? I think that's a really important question to ask here. And Mr. Byers' position is, well, just do the standard colloquy for waiving, a jury trial and having a bench trial. But that wouldn't cover it, right? In this situation, the defendant's waiving, he's not just waiving his right to juror unanimity, he's waiving his rights to confrontation, to call witnesses, to remain silent, to testify if he wants, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I would note that not all of those, Mr. Byers was not advised of all of those rights that he was waiving. So we think that this is going to raise a lot of questions going forward. And in terms of this argument that this will be more efficient for circuit courts, we don't agree with that. I think, will it reduce the number of fully contested trials? Sure. But our concern is it's not going to reduce the number of post-conviction motions that the circuit court is going to see if this procedure is allowed. We expect to see 97406 motions seeking plea withdrawal based on ineffective assistance of counsel. I didn't know that I could admit my guilt at a court trial to reduce charges and still preserve my non-jurisdictional claims for appeal. We expect to see post-conviction motions from defendants who aren't satisfied with their sentence after using this procedure. I think we'll see double jeopardy challenges. Does double jeopardy apply to this proceeding? If it does, when does it attach? And I think we'll see post-conviction motions from defendants who aren't happy with their sentence, similar to what both parties in their briefs, these non-jurisdictional cases that we cited, where defendants are saying, hey, wait a minute, I want to undo this. This was effectively a guilty plea, and it wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
So we Jensen, as long as you're talking about appeals, let me ask you a question. I think if I understand Mr. Lindbergh's argument, he is arguing, hey, you know, my client wanted to look at the state's computer in this case, and he brought up a discovery issue. And the circuit court judge denied him access to the state's computer. And now what is he supposed to do? How does he appeal that? The only way he can appeal that is by either going through a trial, which they didn't want to do. They wanted to, for judicial economy reasons. So they decided to do this instead. Was there some other way? Do you think there's some other way that they could have appealed the circuit court's decision regarding the discovery ruling? What other recourse would someone have if we don't agree to this procedure that was set forth in this case?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So there would be two options, right? The first is the one that we did note in our brief, which is that a person in Mr. Byers' position who wants to, you know, whether I should take a plea or go to trial, can petition for interlocutory appeal. I understand those aren't granted a whole lot, but it is an option for people that think they have a good claim and they want some clarity before they make a decision on what to do. The other option is to enter a plea and to ask the Court of Appeals to overlook the application of the guilty plea waiver rule in that particular case, right? We know it's a rule of administration. Courts can overlook it. So to say, hey, I've got a really good claim here. We think that this is a matter of, you know, statewide concern. Will you address our claim in this particular situation? So those are the options that are already available to defendants in this situation. And again, I think why depart from that when the alternative is to create a new procedure for terminating a criminal case in Wisconsin, which is obviously going to add more work to appellate courts, right? I think that's obvious. I think in this situation, if this procedure is allowed, I don't see why defendants wouldn't want to use this procedure as opposed to a guilty plea. It's a pretty good deal, right? You get the benefit of reduced charges. Maybe you get a recommendation for a particular sentence, and you get to preserve your non-jurisdictional claims for appeal. That's going to create more work for appellate courts. And the question you have to ask is, why should we do that in a case where, you know, why should we require an appellate court to kind of address maybe a routine evidentiary issue or a discovery issue in a case where a defendant has admitted his guilt and consented to a judgment of conviction?
Can I just ask one follow-up, Justice Gallet? Ms. Jansen, do you know of any situations where a circuit court has overlooked the guilty plea waiver rule? And I'm not even asking you to give me the site or the name. I'm just like wondering, even anecdotally, do you know of any situation where that has happened?
Do you mean a situation similar to this, Your Honor?
No, you said when I asked you what other options would be available, the second option you told me was that a defendant could enter a plea. They could then appeal whatever issue they had. In this case, it would be a discovery issue. And then on that appeal, they could say to the Court of Appeals, will you please overlook the guilty plea waiver rule in this case? And I'm just wondering if you know of any instances where that has happened, actually.
We've certainly seen that happen. I don't have a case name for you, but it does happen occasionally, especially if it's a significant issue.
Thanks, Justice Dallet.
Sure. Attorney Jansen, I was listening to you describe kind of how this is such a great procedure for the defendant because he or she gets all these benefits. But isn't the state really the one in control of that? I mean, if we were to say you can have a court trial, you have a right to have a court trial, obviously, and you can stipulate to facts, which doesn't seem like there's anything that prevents that. It's really up to the state. If the state doesn't want to offer in exchange for doing that, dismissing a couple counts, or the state believes that there needs to be something contested that's not being contested, the state doesn't have to agree to the waiver of a jury trial, right?
Well, I guess my response would be is if this is a procedure that's going to be sanctioned, and I guess what we anticipate is that, you know, defense counsel is going to go to the prosecutor and say, well, if you want to resolve this case efficiently, this is what we're offering. And so, you know, the prosecutor is going to face one option, you know, if he wants to move through his cases, which is to go along with this procedure. And I don't think people at the circuit court are really going to be thinking about the burden that that's putting on appellate courts.
Well, there's the flip side to the policy argument here, too, which is the defense, you know, the defendant has a particular issue that wouldn't otherwise get by. And that's where their whole case might hinge on. But this could be an opportunity to get quicker closure, right? Because the alternative might be to go through the formalities of trial and to put everyone to their proof when that's not really what the defense cares about, right? I mean, you know, we don't have a conditional guilty plea, but it provides a very, very limited scenario where the state might agree potentially to allow something that doesn't, you know, isn't currently a statutory exception, or quite frankly, we have other exceptions, right? In ineffective assistance of counsel and otherwise. So it's, we already have some exceptions outside of the statute. But anyway, where this would be allowed. So that there is a policy potentially upside in that it might allow foreclosure, avoids trials where they're unnecessary, and might allow a defendant to just raise a single issue that doesn't otherwise get by the guilty plea waiver issue.
Sure. And I guess, again, I mean, I know you're probably not going to like this answer, but this is kind of how the guilty plea waiver rule works, right? You do, as it currently stands, you've got to go to trial if you want to preserve these issues. But I guess I would reiterate again, there are alternatives to this where you can try to petition for interlocutory appeal and again, or enter the guilty plea and try to ask the courts to address your issue.
Counsel, in response to a question by Justice Dallet regarding the stipulation wording, which included that the defendant agreed to have the court find him guilty based upon the above stipulated set of facts, your opposing counsel, in essence, responded that the drafting could have been tighter. The intention was clear. And then I get to my point. It could have been omitted. And then I don't think we would be here at all. Do you agree with him?
Well,
if that had been omitted, that we wouldn't be here agreeing to have the court find him guilty.
I would say this. I would say the fact that he consented to a judgment of conviction, I think, is what makes this clearly effectively a guilty plea, because that's the hallmark of a plea, is that you're agreeing to be found guilty, or what, you know, if it's no contest or an Alford, you're agreeing to a judgment of conviction. I would say, though, you know, there is language in the stipulation that provides that states that Beyer admits that he knowingly possessed the image of child pornography charged in count one of the information. So that, to me, I have a hard time saying that when you have that admission that we would be able to consider that situation a trial.
Isn't that a fact that he stipulated to, that he admitted?
No. If you look on page two, it's number seven. It specifically says Beyer admits that he knowingly possessed the image of child pornography in the information.
If he had averred that as a statement of fact, I admitted to police, etc., because that is a fact. It certainly is a fact that would inure to his benefit if he wants this procedure to unfold as he intends. Would that be different? I'm trying to find out where we draw the line. It seems to me that you draw the line as it has to be a trial. There has to be something in dispute. What if the two problematic errors, or rather two problematic provisions that we've just identified, his averment regarding his admission and then the one agreeing that the court can find him guilty, if they had been removed and you just had a stipulation of facts, and the stipulation ended with something like, we agree that the court can determine whether or not these facts, support a finding of guilt, something like that. Is that okay? Where do we draw the line?
That's definitely the closer call, Your Honor, is a situation where, like many of the cases we cited in our briefs, the parties are just saying, hey, court, here's a piece of paper. Here are our stipulated facts. You decide what they mean. You decide whether the facts meet the legal elements. There's certainly, in some of the cases, they say that's not effectively a guilty plea because you're asking the court to do something, right? The court's making a decision. Returning to our platinum package, I think it is our position. If you take a look at how this court has recently defined a trial, I would still argue that submitting evidence, and if the defendant is not going to make any argument that the facts don't, meet the legal definition, I think that's not a trial. This court doesn't have to go there, obviously. It could stick with the facts of this particular case.
Can you just expand, maybe it's an expansion of that question, maybe it's not, but Do you want to give us sort of the, you know, the platinum, you know, the gold, the silver, you know, the copper and the plastic versions of your, you know, the ring pop maybe version of what are all the different lines that we can draw here in this case that you feel like are consistent with the state's position in our cases? And because as Justice Bradley suggested, this is largely going to be an exercise of line drawing if we adopt some version of your position. And I'd like to know what some of my options are.
I don't know that I've figured out the ring pop option, but I'll try. I think, again, platinum package is you can't use this procedure for getting around the guilty plea waiver rule, and including language in the opinion that says that a stipulated court trial, though permissible under this court's precedent, Kempe State, still has to meet the definition of a trial. There still has to be a dispute of fact or of law. And I'd refer this court to the Kemp decision. I think it's a good model. I think if you look in the citing references to that case, there's another one, State v. Evans, which used the same procedure. It was a similar situation. Here are all the facts we agree to, but we're gonna argue about what those facts mean. You know, maybe the gold package is to just say that just decided on the facts of this case in a case where we have, you know, an admission to committing a past act and a consent to a judgment of conviction, that is effectively a guilty plea. And again, I think it's clear where it's clear from the record that the parties are utilizing the procedure to get around the guilty plea waiver rule. We do think that that violates Rykoff. I don't know that I have thought through a silver package, so I will stop there unless there are other questions, Justice Sellett.
Attorney Jansen, yes. So are you still, I saw in your brief that you agreed this goes back down no matter what, right? What I just heard you say seemed to be inconsistent with that.
So thank you for asking that, because the remedy has been something that I've struggled with a little bit here just because this has been such a unique situation. I do think in tracking with what happened in Rykoff, I think one option is if this court considers this effectively a guilty plea, is to send it back down and give Mr. Beyer the option of withdrawing his effective guilty plea, because we can see that it wasn't knowing in the sense that he walked into this thinking he could appeal his discovery ruling. The other option that we've proposed, which I'm not certain is workable, is to say, you know, this is effectively a guilty plea. You know, the guilty plea waiver rule applies here, but we're going to overlook it. It's a rule of administration, and we will address the merits of Mr. Beyer's discovery claim. That was an option we proposed at the Court of Appeals as well, acknowledging that, you know, we did make a mistake, obviously, at the outset of this by agreeing to this. So I'm not sure that's a perfect fit. That might be something that your honors are going to have to wrestle with, but those are the two options we came up with. And unless there are any other further questions.
Just one more follow-up on that. Can you respond to the argument that you should be judicially stopped from raising this at all, considering you agreed to this and got a benefit from it as well?
Sure. I think that would be a fair argument for Mr. Beyer to have raised, that or waiver. I understand we agreed to this. What we would have said in response is, it's a rule of judicial administration, judicial estoppel is, and we'd ask the court to overlook it here because we have identified, we think we've raised a very valid question here. The Court of Appeals ultimately certified this issue to this court. This court accepted the certification. So we think that would support our position that you should overlook estoppel or waiver here, given the situation. There are no further questions. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Attorney Lindberg, are you prepared for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Just to track some of this discussion of clarity, nothing the state is offering the court today really provides any clarity. There's no well-defined line that they're drawing. They're saying that that asking the court to render a verdict and make inferences based on stipulated facts is okay and does not implicate the guilty plea waiver rule, so long as there is some point of contention upon which there's argument. I I think that Justice Hagedorn kind of hit this on the head with his discussion of the tax laws. If that's the holding this court makes, there's nothing to stop defendants and the state, where the state agrees to it, from submitting several stipulations of fact and then having one point of nominal contention and saying that and arguing that that's a dispute which then would satisfy which would satisfy the criteria as a trial versus a guilty plea. So I think that there's more clarity as is than there would be were the court to adopt the state's reasoning in this case. And then finally, I regret that I didn't get a lot of time to discuss the discovery issue and the suppression issue in this case. I would reiterate that this is a rare occurrence because it's a factually and legally unique situation. And I note that child pornography, the production of it, the distribution of it, the viewing of it, it's a terrible, reprehensible crime, as Justice Kurofsky alluded to. Sometimes, though, it seems like that reprehensibility unavoidably, but perhaps unduly, colors the sort of discussion about an alleged offender's rights. It feels like they're given short shrift. The consistency which with the state has been able to avoid scrutiny of its investigative processes is unparalleled in our experience in comparison to other criminal cases. The state assures us that its methods are all legal and reliable, but rarely is ever made to definitively prove as much. We're glad that the court's taking this into consideration. I hope it does, and takes the time to review the full case in addition to the question on certification, because I think that there is a compelling argument that buyer deserves and merits the relief which he's requesting. And if there are no other questions, I'll rest, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you both for a very interesting case and interesting argument. We will adjourn now while we get ready for our second argument of the day. We are adjourned.